that while we are changing the climate for the worst through our infinitesimal actions, we can also change it for the better through equally infinitesimal actions.
Welcome to a special holiday edition of the 2 Degrees Show. This week, in an extended programme, we're delighted to be able to bring you a recording of a talk given by the award-winning journalist George Monbiot. Author of a number of best-selling books, in 1995 he was presented with a UN Global 500 Award for Outstanding Environmental Achievement by Nelson Mandela. Turning his attention to the world's most serious and urgent challenge, George has devised a plan of action for the UK to enable it to meet the highly ambitious target of 90% CO2 reductions by 2030, which George calculates we need. Policymakers in the UK continue to move at a snail's pace, whereas, as George outlines, we need to implement radical plans of action with a matter of urgency and stand up to the vested interests that until now have been standing in the way of effective action. The following speech was given by George to a rapturous audience at a packed to the rafters Sheldonian Theatre in Oxford on October the 19th, 2006, to mark the publication of his book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning.
Thank you very much, George, and thank you everyone for coming. It's a wonderful turnout, slightly daunting one. One of the problems with climate change is that it stretches our imagination almost to breaking point in several respects. First, we have to accept that our tiny, our infinitesimal actions achieve something that almost all prior generations have sought to achieve. In the past, people have danced for rain or prayed for the winter to end with no prospect whatsoever of success. But now, without even trying, or so we have to believe, we are altering the characteristics of the entire atmospheric system. The second almost impossible thing that we have to believe is that we are doing so through means which have hitherto, under the old morality, been considered either wholly innocent or indeed actually good. Turning on the lights, making a cup of tea, picking up the kids from school. Perhaps the most intractable cause of global warming of all is the phenomenon I call love miles. Love miles is the distance between yourself and the people you love. If you've got a brother who's getting married in New York or a daughter who's living in Australia, you have a moral obligation to go and see those people, to go to that wedding, to go and see your daughter in Australia. And in doing so, you are committing, under the new morality, one of the worst acts of destruction you could possibly commit. And here we see two moral codes, the old one and the new one, in irreconcilable antagonism. The old one, according to the way we have lived up till now, is perfectly valid. The new one achieves a validity which is wholly new according to the way that we must live in the future. And in order to accept that that morality has wholly changed and that the things which were previously good are now also bad requires an almost implausible leap of the imagination. But perhaps hardest of all to grasp is this, that while we are changing the climate for the worst through our infinitesimal actions, we can also change it for the better through equally infinitesimal actions. And this, it seems, is about the hardest thing in this whole crazy story of climate change for most people to grasp. One of the more frightening things I've witnessed, especially in the past few weeks, is this extraordinary transition from the point a year or two ago at which people were saying, oh, is it really that much of an issue? In this climate change business, you know, there's some dispute about it. I mean, there's some people who say it's not happening, and if it is happening, well, you know, we can grow grapes in Yorkshire and we'll have a Mediterranean climate in the south of England. Is that really such a bad thing? And do we really have to do anything about it? Because that suggests, you know, we'll be going over the top, we'll be doing too much in terms of potentially damaging the economy and all the rest of it for something which might not even be real. To almost a mirror image of that, almost overnight, where people were saying, it's too late, you can't do anything. And in both cases, it's a complete abdication of responsibility. But it's also a reflection of the imaginative effort required to see that we can do something about it. And that's what I intend to discuss tonight. But before I do, I just want very briefly to remind you of why we must do something about it. Last year, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization published a paper showing that in the 40 or so poorest countries on Earth, almost all of which are water-stressed in one way or another already, climate change will have the effect of greatly increasing food insecurity and, as a result, increasing hunger. That effect, they said, would be partly offset by the fact that in the richer nations, or rather the temperate nations, and by cosmic shuffling, it turns out that most of the rich nations are in the temperate areas, which is why we've done so little about climate change so far. They pointed out that in the temperate nations you can expect an increase in food production. So while it might lead to local food insecurity, globally we shouldn't have to worry about the total volume of food available for feeding people. And the reason they said that there was going to be this increase in the temperate regions was that, A, the temperature rises, which increases plant productivity in temperate areas, not in tropical areas on the whole, because those are already, you're pretty close to the physiological limits of a lot of crop plants. But B, there's going to be more carbon dioxide in the air, and that acts as a fertilizer because that's a key component, obviously, of plant growth. Then, at the end of last year, a paper was published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, I'm sure you all read it, which showed that, unfortunately, the second part of this equation was wildly optimistic. Field experiments showed that, A, the carbon dioxide had much less of a fertilizing effect than the Food and Agriculture Organization had supposed, but B, that alongside the emission of high quantities of carbon dioxide is the emission of high quantities of ozone, another low-level pollutant caused by cars and by planes and by industry. And ozone has a very inhibiting effect on crop growth, and it's sufficient to knock it back to the extent or greater than the extent of the expected growth. And then, this month, in the Journal of Hydrometeorology, again, I don't suppose I have to explain this paper to you, because you will all have rushed to the library to read it when it came out. This month, in the Journal of Hydrometeorology, was a paper showing, well, really resolving one of the big disputes and questions among climate scientists, which is that the question of whether the world will become generally wetter or generally drier as a result of climate change this century. It was always a difficult one to resolve because as temperatures increase, the rate of evaporation increases, and that in turn leads to a higher rate of cloud formation and a higher rate of rainfall. Simultaneously, the rate of evaporation, an increase in it, leads to the drying out of the soil. What would the net effect be? Would it mean that places would get drier or wetter as a whole? Well, this paper has made it clear that according to the latest models and the best available information at the moment, the world will undergo quite a severe net drying this century. You put that together with the findings published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, and you see that we have a potential formula for a net food deficit by 2100. It is beyond my powers of description to tell you what a net food deficit in a world with 9 billion people or more would look like. No war, no plague, no famine, no act of genocide would even compare to the scale of human suffering which we would be talking about then. They become sideshows at the circus of suffering by comparison to the threat hanging over us now of climate change. These are not the only possible scenarios which have been mooted for what's going to happen this century. Perhaps the most intriguing one was one sent to me by a correspondent of mine who wrote the following. Dear Mr. Monbiot, thank you for drawing attention to the threat of climate change. It really is extremely serious. If we don't act soon, the entire planet will turn into a desert. Well, I've investigated this possibility and I regret to inform you that it's not very likely. Although baked Alaska and floating islands did come to mind. The first thing I try to do in the book is to see what sort of a cut in a main greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, is necessary if we are to have a high chance of preventing runaway climate change from taking place. Now, this runaway climate change is very important. There are a number of biological systems, a number of ecosystems, which will start to release either carbon dioxide or an even more powerful greenhouse gas, methane, if temperatures rise to a certain point. I'll point to one example, which is the West Siberian peat bog, which alone contains 73 times as much greenhouse gas as all human beings produce every year. That's been locked up to this point because it's in permafrost. But as the permafrost begins to melt, and we already saw the first signs this summer, that methane begins to be released. As more methane is released, the rate of global warming increases and the rate of permafrost melting increases. And what we see here is a formula for this positive feedback, this runaway climate change, which means that if we allow ourselves to reach a certain point as far as global temperatures are concerned, it is then out of our hands. There is nothing that we can do. The ecosystem, or the biosphere, the totality of the world's ecosystems, then takes over as the primary source of greenhouse gases. And effectively it means that if we reach what many scientists consider to be the crucial point of 2 degrees warming above pre-industrial levels, 3 degrees becomes an inevitability. If we reach 3 degrees, then 4 degrees becomes unstoppable. It is critical that we prevent global temperatures from rising by 2 degrees or more above their pre-industrial levels. And it's critical that we do that as quickly as possible. Now, taking into account the probability that a certain concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere correlates to a certain temperature, taking into account the biosphere's declining ability to absorb carbon as the century goes on, and taking into account the increase in human population expected this century, I've tried to work out what the necessary cut will be if we're not to get to 2 degrees of warming above pre-industrial levels. We've already got to 0.7 degrees above, but if we're not to cover that last 1.3 degrees. And here's the bad news. In order to have a high chance of doing that, an 80 to 90% chance, we require a 60% cut worldwide by 2030. Now, if that cut is to be distributed equally so that everybody on Earth has an equal right to produce carbon dioxide, that means that in the rich nations like the United Kingdom, we require a cut of 90% by 2030. This is not a conclusion I wanted to come to. It would have been an awful lot easier to come to a conclusion which required a much smaller cut, but 90% by 2030. And what I have to try to do is to demonstrate that that is plausible. And this is where, yet again, the imagination gets severely taxed. Before I do that, I want very briefly to discuss why it is that we've got to this pass. Why it is that in 2006, 110 years after Svante Arrhenius first worked out that greenhouse gases cause an increase in global temperature, 30 years after scientists first started blowing the whistle that this could be a serious issue, why it is that we have done pretty well precisely nothing about it. Now, there are several reasons, but one of those I investigated in particular in the book was the work of what I call the denial industry. And this is a network of public relations agencies, which don't call themselves public relations agencies, they call themselves think tanks or NGOs or even research institutions. But they're neither composed of ordinary unpaid citizens like ourselves, or composed of scientists, or indeed composed of people who think very much at all. Except in, under perhaps Rory Bremner's definition of a think tank as an organisation that thinks about tanks. But these groups have been funded, and we've known for quite a long time now, primarily by the oil company ExxonMobil, but then by several other companies involved in coal and other aspects of the fossil fuel industry, to spread doubt about the science of climate change. And first of all, to say that it's not happening. And then, after they could no longer sustain that line, they're saying, well, it's happening, but it's a good thing. And then after they could no longer sustain that line, they're saying, it's happening, it's a bad thing, but it would cost too much to do anything about it. Very soon they're going to say, it's happening, and it's now too late, so tough. And if it is too late, those people will be partly to blame. But one of the interesting things that I discovered in researching this is that while Exxon became the primary funder, it was not the first funder, and it was not the group which set up some of the most important of these climate change denial agencies. That, interestingly, was not a fossil fuel company at all. It was the tobacco company, Philip Morris. It's a very strange and counterintuitive finding. But basically, Philip Morris was trying to prevent the Environmental Protection Agency in the US from imposing a ban on smoking in the workplace and in public places. And it was trying to cast doubt upon the science of passive smoking, of secondhand cigarette smoke and the effects that it has on people. But in order not to have its fingerprints all over these fake grassroots groups and fake scientific institutes and fake think tanks thinking about tanks, in order not to be seen to be involved, it threw up, so to speak, a smokescreen. And it said to the people it was paying, don't just campaign on passive smoking, campaign in all other areas of so-called junk science, i.e. any science which corporations don't like. And top of that list was global warming. And the people it funded became the most effective advocates within this denial industry. And only later did they take their funding from ExxonMobil. But what's also very interesting is that if you look at the primary people in this denial industry working for the fossil fuel companies, almost all of them, in one incarnation or another, were previously working for the tobacco companies, denying the effects of tobacco. It's a very similar industry. In fact, it is the same industry. But if these people have been effective, it is because we have wanted to believe them. We have wanted to believe that we can carry on as we are. We have wanted to believe that no great disruptive change is needed. We have wanted to believe that we need not wake up from this fossil fuel-induced dream through which we are all sleepwalking. And if the door has been opened to them, it is because we have left it ajar. Okay, so this is where we are. Not too late yet, but not far off. In the year 2006, about 20 or 30 years before, after we should have started mobilising on this. And we have, within 24 years, to achieve a 90% cut in carbon emissions. Where do we begin? How on earth do you start this extraordinary task? Well, it seems to me that it's critical that we start it with a system at all would be useful, but a system which is fair. Because in situations like this, the most effective systems tend to be the fairest ones. In December 1940, in his essay, The Lion and the Unicorn, Orwell observed the following. He said, the lady in the Rolls-Royce car does more to destroy national morale than a fleet of Goering's bomber planes. And what he meant by that was that it was very hard for a nation to feel it was pulling together if it felt that its sacrifices were uneven. That if some people didn't have to make sacrifices, that was disastrous for wider public spiritedness when it came to all the privations required in order to win the war with Hitler. And it seems to me that we need a system similar to the rationing system then. In fact, we need a carbon rationing system. If you imposed a taxation system, by contrast, the rich could carry on living exactly as they wanted, while the poor would be required greatly to cut back on the amount of energy they used. With a rationing system, the rich will still use more energy, but only after they've given a significant amount of their income to the poor. Because you all have a ration which represents the amount of energy that you consume directly. You use it for paying your electricity bill, your gas bill, filling up your tank with petrol, buying plane tickets, buying train tickets. And that ration goes down a little bit every year in line with the cut required, the 90% cut required, to get to where we need to get. If you use more than your ration, or you want to use more than your ration across the course of a year, you can buy surplus from people who've used less. And as, by and large, the poor use less than the rich, you can see quite a significant mechanism for a transfer of wealth here. By itself, though, it's not enough. The ration is a great incentivizer in that if people say, right, what's being rationed here is carbon rather than energy, and I want to carry on living as close as possible to the way I live now, I must reduce the carbon content of my energy use. So instantly you have a market for energy-efficient light bulbs and for public transport and for all sorts of other available means of saving carbon while continuing to light your house and to move around and all the rest of it. But it's not enough, because the market alone cannot fund some of the infrastructural changes required, and there are people, very poor people, who have terrible houses which they can't afford to insulate, for example. So again, they need help. So I'm going to briefly sketch out some of the other changes which need to take place to make that carbon rationing system work. And I'll start with our homes. And I began by looking into what sort of cut we could get as far as energy efficiency is concerned from our houses by 2030, within this very short period of 24 years. And it's not as good as I was hoping it would be. A lot of environmentalists have claimed that you could get an 80 or 90% cut purely through energy efficiency measures in the home. And in your own home, and if you're a really committed environmentalist, then maybe you can. But across the entire housing stock, it is, I'm afraid, in the timescale, impossible to get anywhere near that. 30 to 40% is about the best we're likely to be able to do. Partly because our homes are so cruddy. We've got the oldest and the worst housing stock in Western Europe, and a lot of it is almost beyond repair. But there's a staggering amount which can be done, even within those constraints. Just to throw a couple of things at you, 10% of homes in this country have no insulation of any kind whatsoever. Nothing. Not in the loft, not in the floor, not in the walls, nothing at all. There are 17 million houses in the UK out of a total of 25.5 million which have cavity walls. But of those 17 million, only 6 million have cavity wall insulation. It's an extraordinary thing that, given that this is where you get your very rapid payback, it costs almost nothing and it pays for itself very quickly. People still aren't prepared to do this. And it shows how staggeringly slow we have been to take energy efficiency seriously in this country. And then when it comes to the gadgets that we use, it almost makes you tear your hair out in despair. Why is it that the incandescent light bulb is still on sale in this country? It's incomprehensible when you consider what we're up against. Why is it that the incandescent light bulb is almost universal in this country? Why is it that we are still comfortable with the idea of going to buy plasma screen TVs, which per square inch of screen use 5 times as much energy as a cathode ray tube TV? Why is it that you cannot, for love or money, and we spent 3 days looking, buy a top-of-the-range fridge or freezer in this country? You can get these fridges and freezers with what are called vacuum-insulated panels, which have a massive impact on slashing the electricity that they use, but you simply cannot buy them in the United Kingdom. Well, I'll answer that particular question. It's because we had an energy rating system which went from A to G, and you knew that if you bought an A-rated appliance, like a fridge or a freezer, you were buying the top-rated appliance. The manufacturers very sneakily, through the European Commission, said, we totally take into account this idea that we must raise our energy efficiency standards as we go along, and your notion was that the A range would get better and better, and they would all get better and better down this line. We'd like to do a slightly different system. We'd like to start adding categories. So now the top-rated fridge and freezer is an A++, but nobody knows it exists. Because they go into the showroom and there's an A-rated fridge or freezer and say, that's the top. That's what you'd expect to be the top. And so there's no demand at all for an A++, because nobody knows that you can get such a thing. And so actually the A-rated fridge or freezer is the C-rated fridge or freezer. And the real A is nowhere to be found. We spent 3 days phoning everyone on the internet, every possible means, and could not find one of these things. They just are not available for sale. And the same across this huge range of appliances and gadgets and gizmos. So clearly, there is a lot which can be done, but not fast enough to get us near that cut. The first thing which needs to be done, obviously, as far as houses are concerned, is a massive improvement in building regulations. And it's just mad that in Britain in 2006, our building regulations, as far as energy efficiency is concerned, are worse than they were in Sweden in 1978. It is also the case that since 1985, when our energy efficiency regulations were first introduced, there has not been a single prosecution for non-compliance anywhere in the whole country. And that's despite the fact that roughly 60% of builders don't meet the energy efficiency standards in the building regs. And when people have investigated this, they've found, for example, that house after house has the requisite amount of insulation in the loft, but it's still tied up in bales because they haven't been bothered to roll it out. A constant, ridiculous, insane problems like this because no one is interested, no one's bothered with it. It's just been right at the bottom of people's priorities. And it seems to me that we need building regulations which are not just much, much stricter when it comes to building new houses, but which are also applied when it comes to refurbishing existing houses. And we need regulations which say, for example, you cannot rent out a house until it meets certain efficiency standards. All sorts of things which we do with fire regs, for instance, today, but that's just not applied to this even bigger global fire that we need to deal with. But, as I say, we can't get all the way there through efficiency, so we have to decarbonize. We have to reduce the carbon content of the energy supply to those homes. And I look first at electricity, and I come up with a rather heretical position, one which a lot of environmentalists don't like at all, but I'm afraid it's the position I was driven towards, which is this idea that we're only really going to achieve the sort of generation efficiencies which are required if we go for the macro-renewable generation rather than the micro-renewable generation. Now, there have been an awful lot of companies out there, B&Q has just joined their throng, who are desperate to sell you mini wind turbines to put on your roof, or indeed solar panels to put on your roof. And if you look at B&Q's website today, they will tell you that you can produce about 30% of your electricity needs from a rooftop micro turbine of, it's about 1.75 metres in diameter. It's complete rubbish. As far as average household electricity demand is concerned, you get about 5%. Of course, if you've massively cut back and you've greatly reduced your energy efficiency, greatly improved your energy efficiency, you might get 30%, but that's not what they're selling. They're saying that as houses stand, you can get a 30% of your electricity from this microgenerator. And it's simply not the case, and the reason for that is several-fold. Number one, the average wind speeds in urban areas, in fact, most of the areas where people live, generally they live in the least windy places, out of choice, are 4 metres per second or lower, and you get virtually nothing out of a wind turbine at that speed. Number two, in order not to get constantly subjected to turbulence, you need to put your turbine on a stick at least 10 metres above any obstacle within a 100 metre radius. Other people's houses, trees, whatever it happens to be. I mean, by the time you've done that, you've got a minor hazard to aircraft. And then if you want to produce 30 or 50% of your house's electricity from a wind turbine on your roof, you're going to need something 3 to 4 metres across. And that alone is sufficient to rip the gable end of your house off as a result of the lateral thrust. So it doesn't make any sense to go down that route. And because you're basically putting your energy generator where the energy isn't. And my feeling is that our renewable generators should be put where there's the greatest ambient energy. And above all, that's right out at sea. With every 100 kilometres from the coast, you get an extra metre per second of wind speed, and the wind tends to be more consistent. It seems to me that far from going to these localised, decentralised, micro-generating networks, which a lot of people are talking about, far from shutting down large parts of the national grid, we should be extending the grid outwards, right out, to cover a great deal of the continental shelf, and putting these enormous wind turbines, maybe 10 megawatt wind turbines, right out wherever the water is shallow enough to station them. One of the great advantages of this is that hardly anyone gets to see them. The only people whose aesthetic sensibilities are offended will be trawlermen. But it also means that you get a less intermittent supply. If you can start stretching out into different parts of the continental shelf, as Graham Sinden, who's in this audience, has shown in some very interesting papers, showing that the more you can diversify the places from which your energy comes, the more reliable it is, and the less likely you are to have interruptions in supply. Now, this has hitherto been difficult because of the costs and the transmission losses of electricity caused by our pylon system, these enormous pylons of the sort which you see striding into Oxford, which are so deservedly unpopular. And it seems to me that much of that problem can be overcome by starting to deploy, instead of these alternating current lines which we use at the moment, high voltage direct current lines, which beyond a certain distance are cheaper, and they also have fewer losses in transmission of electricity. In fact, so low are those losses that they can go up to 4,500 kilometres long. Already in the undemocratic non-republic of Congo, there is a line 1,700 kilometres long, and they can go much further. Now, if you start deploying lines like this, there's almost no limit to where you can draw your energy from. For years, some rogue environmentalists have been talking about the idea of using solar farms in the Sahara to power Europe. And they've been probably quite rightly dismissed as nutters. But now it's beginning to look plausible. If you make use of a much better integrated grid in these longer lines, there is a possibility that you could start making use of this. And the great thing about the Sahara is that it runs from east to west. When the sun's going down on one end, it's coming up at the other end. And what you have there across that, 4,000 miles or so, is basically the potential for reliable, renewable electricity almost all the way around the clock, or at least covering all those times when our electricity demand reaches its peak. And it seems that far from shutting down the national grid, we should start integrating our grid with that of other European countries. And maybe Europe should start integrating with Africa and with Asia. And maybe we should be looking towards a global electricity grid. Because that permits us to start tapping into much more reliable supplies and much wider supplies than before. But I'm talking about the easy bit here. It might not sound like it. The big problem that we face in our homes is that 82% of our demand for energy there takes the form of heat, not electricity. And heat is a rather tougher matter to deal with because you can't transmit it over vast distances as you can with electricity. And the potential renewable resources which we could use to generate that heat are rather harder to tap into. I've looked at the potential for generating a lot of it with biomass, with woody material, and found that if we used about 20% of the land area in Britain on which it could be grown, we would produce about 19% of our heat demand, even taking into account a 40% cut in the total demand for energy. And if we go beyond that point, then we're starting to look at a serious reduction in the amount of food that we supply, and that has major impacts on peoples all over the world. So, That by itself can't do it, nor unfortunately can solar thermal panels, so they are useful, but they only take us, if you look at all the places which are suitable to take them, a few extra percent along the way. Similarly with ground-sourced heat pumps, where you draw heat from the ground, you've got great potential there for many homes, but by no means coverage across the whole country for homes which are suitable to take those. When you put every possibility together, you get about 40% of our reduced demand for heat being met by those renewable supplies. And it's been a source of tremendous headaches to me to try to find a means of cutting the carbon content of our heat demand by the necessary amount. And the only system I can come up with, which is, I admit, an unsatisfactory one, but it's the closest thing I can come to answering this question, and if there's anyone in the audience who's got a better answer, I'd love to hear about it, but at the end of the talk, is a hydrogen system. And a system where, instead of burning natural gas in our combi boilers at home, we burn hydrogen. Now, we already know that hydrogen can be burnt in combi boilers. We already know that hydrogen can be piped over very long distances. It's done in various industries already. We know that hydrogen can be produced by at least two means, which means that its production has a very low carbon content. One, the more expensive means, is through the electrolysis of water. You use electricity, unfortunately itself quite an expensive product, to electrolyse water, and you all remember from O-level chemistry that hydrogen starts bubbling out. Those who didn't play truant. Seems to include most of our journalists who haven't the faintest idea about any of this stuff. And then you could also do it through the steam reformation of gas, sort of cracking methane effectively, and you can capture the carbon dioxide from the exhaust of those plants and potentially, theoretically at least, pipe it away and bury it in old gas aquifers or saline aquifers. Neither of these systems are wholly satisfactory, but is the only way I can see at the moment of making up that shortfall. If we were to have a system like this, a hydrogen piping system, for example, it would require a massive investment in infrastructure and a lot of digging up of streets and all sorts of other unpopular things. But it's not outside the bounds of plausibility. It's just within them, but it would be tough and it would require a big political commitment. So I'm not 100% sure that I'm there, but I've got my antennae up for any better ideas. I have to be quite brief with all this, so I'm going to move on now to transport. And here we find almost the opposite problem, that the technological solutions are there and just crying out to be embraced, but you encounter instead this massive cultural resistance. It could almost be boiled down to two words, Jeremy Clarkson. Not entirely by himself, perhaps, but he represents a tendency which says that this is my car. I can do whatever the heck I want in this car. I will drive it how I want, where I want. I will choose whatever model I want. And anyone who interferes with that right is a lycra-wearing Nazi sandalista from Islington who is part of the communist global conspiracy to bring capitalism to an end. I do not exaggerate. This is what these people say, including Clarkson himself, rather more wittily than I do, I admit. But and it's so frustrating because there are these brilliant possibilities. At the moment, we have a vast investment, both by the private sector and by governments, in two things. One, a hydrogen network for running cars off hydrogen, with hydrogen fuel cells or internal combustion engines using hydrogen in the car. And two, biofuels. In both cases, I think it's a complete disaster. The hydrogen thing, because there's no way that it's a widespread hydrogen network running cars can possibly be ready for within 20 or 30 years. Simply because the basic problem of how you transport the hydrogen around in your car without driving a moving bomb is something which simply has not been cracked, and there's a huge amount of technical problems. The National Academy of Engineering in the States wrote this vast 200-page report about how it could be done if we did this and that, and we overcame this problem and the other, and at the end they said, and all these projections are extremely optimistic. And even so, they couldn't see anything happening before 2025. And that's too late. We've got to make the major cuts right now. And yet, in the US, Bush's government has invested $2 billion in trying to develop a hydrogen network. The EU has invested almost exactly the same amount, and Japan has invested almost exactly the same amount. This money is being wasted. Similarly, with biofuels, we now have an obligation in the UK that 6% of all our transport fuel is produced by biodiesel or bioethanol, in other words, fuels from plants, by, I think it's 2010. And that by 2020, it's 20% of all our transport fuels. This is a formula for a global humanitarian catastrophe. I've done a calculation for the United Kingdom showing that if we were to produce the requisite amount by 2020 from growing rape, it would require almost all our land area to just get that 20% of our transport fuels. There are currently 5.7 million hectares of arable land in the United Kingdom. To supply, keep all the cars on the road would require 27.9 million hectares of arable land. You roll out this 20% requirement across Europe, as they're already discussing. You do the same thing in the United States, as they're discussing over there, and you will see a head-on confrontation between the requirement to feed people and the requirement to feed cars. And in any contest between those two, the outcome is predetermined, because, by definition, people who run cars have more money than those who are at danger of starvation. And you're basically setting up an almost perfectly calculated formula for mass starvation by pursuing these biofuels. I think it is profoundly immoral to turn land over, which was previously providing food for people, to providing fuel for cars. But even worse, and even more immediately, currently the cheapest source of biodiesel is palm oil. And palm oil plantations are currently the primary cause of deforestation in Malaysia and Indonesia. The main market is now the European biodiesel market. This is why vast areas of tropical forest are being cleared. And there the tropical forest is these enormous dipterocarps, these huge sticks of wet carbon. And as they are cut down and either rot or burn, that carbon is oxidized and turns into carbon dioxide. As the peat on which they grow dries out, the carbon in the peat oxidizes and turns into carbon dioxide. In terms of its impact on climate change, palm oil-based biodiesel is worse than fossil fuel by a very, very long way. The government looked into this and said, well, maybe we could ban it. Maybe we could have non-palm oil biodiesel in this country. And they commissioned a vast report, which goes to 200 pages again, this huge, huge report, looking into all this, and they said, no, that would be illegal under World Trade Organization rules. Despite that, they are going ahead with this, as a result of which palm oil has now become such a popular fuel in this country that there are power stations burning it in order to meet their obligations, in order to get certificates under the renewables obligation. And it's a completely false economy as far as carbon is concerned. So that's what not to do. What to do instead? Well, I've begun in my old age to fancy the electric car. Now, there's a major problem with the electric car, which we're all familiar with. It works, and it does pretty well. It moves when you want it to move, except when it's already done about 200 miles, when the battery runs out. You then have to plug it in, and you have to leave it for several hours before you can drive it again. And people don't want that. It's not going to work. What I propose is that the network of filling stations we have at the moment start dispensing not petrol, but electricity. In your electric car, you have a great big battery which you do not own. You lease it instead from this network of filling stations. And as you begin to run down, you pull into your filling station, a crane comes over, lifts the battery out and sticks another one in which is fully charged, and off you go again. It takes no more time than filling your tank. It's so bleeding simple that you simply cannot understand why €2 million are being spent on developing a hydrogen network, when for about 1/100th of that, we could develop a network which actually allowed the electric car to function. And from my perspective, and maybe there's a dreadful flaw I haven't noticed, I'm sure someone will point it out if there is, it all fits in very nicely. Because if we've got these massive, great offshore wind farms producing, chuntering out loads and loads of energy all through the day and all through the night, in other words, whether we're using that electricity or not, you've got a great big generating surplus at night when our electricity demand goes right down. What do you do with it? Well, you use it to charge up those batteries. And here you've got the potential for making sure that electricity is not wasted. It's going to be very cheap electricity. It's going to be effectively carbon-free electricity. But just finding better ways to drive the private car is not sufficient. And it seems to me we must also find ways to get people out of their cars and onto entire systems which work much more efficiently in terms of their carbon. And there is, I believe, a means of doing this. And the really bad news is that it revolves around the coach. How many people here have been in a coach in the past year? And of those people, how many people would disagree with the proposition that it is a dismal and humiliating experience? A handful. I mean, if I wanted to drive to Cambridge, I don't possess a car, but if I did and I wanted to drive to Cambridge, I could get there in about 110 minutes. By the time I'd gone to the city centre coach station, got on the coach, been shoved on by some bloke who looks like he's just drunk a quart of vinegar, sat down in a chair designed to extract confessions, and then trundled all the way out of Oxford, and then all the way through every depressing dormitory town between here and Cambridge, and then reached my destination there, it takes me 4 hours. And I feel, by the time I got there, like a 22nd class citizen. And the reason why it's such a totally dismal and humiliating experience is that the way the system is run is totally and utterly stupid. It's a hangover from the period when coaches were pulled by horses and were probably faster. And the basic problem is this, and this was pointed out by a very smart guy, an economist called Alan Storkey, in a paper which he hasn't even published. The basic problem is this, that the coach stations are in the city centres. And what Storkey proposes is shutting down those city centre coach stations and moving them out to the junctions of the motorways. On every motorway, you have an entire lane, or eventually perhaps more, dedicated to coaches and coaches alone. Then you extend your urban transport networks, your public transport networks, out to those motorway junctions to meet them. Your dedicated bus lanes, your tramways, your underground lines, whatever they are, out to meet those coach stations. The coaches don't go anywhere except the motorways. They just go up and down the motorways all the time on these dedicated lanes. In doing so, they maintain an average speed which can be a pretty consistent 60 miles an hour. Why? Because if you suddenly moved from cars to coaches, you would find that you had in your motorways tremendous overcapacity. The M25, 108 miles, 7.5 lanes altogether, if you include both directions. What's that? 700 odd miles of road. If everyone's travelling at 60 miles an hour in a car, at the average loading of a car, 1.56 people, I've never seen a car with 1.56 people in, but that is apparently the average loading, that entire road, entire orbital road, 700 odd miles of lanes, can take 19,000 people. That's all. That is, the capacity of the M25 is 19,000 people, if those people are in cars. If they're in coaches, it's 250,000. One coach hoovers up a mile of car traffic. It's also 90% more efficient than the car. Even with the cruddy old coaches we have today, per passenger kilometre, we already get a 90% cut. We're already there. And what if we were to adopt Storkey's proposal, we do two things. First of all, you revitalise your urban public transport networks because they start serving the suburbs properly on the way to the motorway junctions as well as just the city centre. And secondly, you have a fast coach service. And it could even be a comfortable one. I mean, what a dream that could be. You could have TV screens. You could have a comfortable enough seat to fall asleep. And it could actually be promoted as a better alternative. Better still than being in your car. With a 90% carbon cut. And my calculations suggest that on the average journey of 100 miles or more across the UK, the coach system would actually be faster than going by private car. So here we have a means by which we could actually offer people something. It's not just you're going to have to suffer privations, but here's something good. Here's something which would actually be more convenient. It'd be cheaper, it'd be faster, it'd be more convenient than the crazy, ridiculous system that we use at the moment. And it would cost nothing to set up. The motorways are already there. You need to build some coach stations on the junctions, but in shutting down the city centre ones, you get a great bonanza, loads and loads of money, because those city centre sites are very valuable indeed. You need a few extra traffic lights and transponders in the coaches so they respond like ambulances do and turn the lights green and all that. But you're away. It's a very, very simple system. The difficulty, as I say, is in not with the technological and the economic problem, it is with this Jeremy Clarkson problem that that the longer people stay in their cars, the more libertarian they become, the less available they are, the less amenable they are to the argument that they can in any way be restricted. Okay, I'm running out of time now, so I'm very quickly going to talk about aviation, one of the other main topics. And here I'm afraid, when asked the question, what is the technological substitute for aviation, the answer is, there isn't one. Nowhere on the horizon is there a sensible fuel proposed which could which could take the place of kerosene, which is the current fuel that planes use, without causing even greater environmental problems than kerosene currently causes. The high-pressure bypass jet turbine engine has been used since 1947, and every possible efficiency has already been extracted from it. When Richard Branson goes on about saying, through efficiency and through new fuels, I'm going to transform the way that people fly and massively cut the amount of carbon dioxide, he is talking through his hat. Because within the necessary time frame, those options simply do not exist. There is no new alternative engine on the horizon. There is no new alternative fuel on the horizon. Nowhere near the time frame that we need to be talking about. In fact, Branson's rather innovative solution is that he makes this $3 billion he doesn't have, and yet he says he's going to invest, by expanding his fleet of planes in order that we then finance him to develop this unicorn of a proposal, which simply does not exist, to solve the problem he's just created. We destroy the planet in order to save it. Not an approach I think any of us should support. And I've looked at every possibility and all the claims which the air transport people make, every single one of which falls apart under examination, and found that there is simply no way that we can carry on flying in anything like the numbers that we do today without causing a massive, massive impact on the climate. By and large, we need to cut the amount of flights we take by 90% if we're going to deal with this problem. So it means that under a carbon rationing system, yes, you can still fly, but you're going to have to save up a heck of a lot of carbon rations over a long time in order to take that flight. Otherwise, you'll have to travel overland or very, very slowly by some other means. Airships is a possibility, not currently a popular one, but one which perhaps bears further examination. But planes, we just can't carry on the way we are. Now, a lot of environmentalists have called for carbon taxes, aviation fuel tax, to restrict the number of planes. There are two major problems. One is that even with very, very big aviation fuel taxes, they can absorb those costs. The costs of running an airline seem to be coming down every year. But secondly, it's almost impossible under international law. The Chicago Convention, backed up by 4,000 bilateral side agreements, locks into place the idea that you cannot impose aviation fuel tax. So when environmentalists call for this, there effectively is a bit like that story of Brer Rabbit who says, please, please, Sir the Fox, throw me anywhere except into the briar patch. Fox throws him into the briar patch and he just disappears like that because rabbits love briar patches. And is what the aviation industry wants us to be calling for is aviation fuel tax, because they know that it can't possibly happen. Instead, it seems to me, the only thing which can happen and can do this in the necessary time frame is a restriction on airport capacity. Far from building more and more airports as the government is currently envisaging, we actually reduce the amount of airport space we have already, reduce the amount of landing slots, eventually reduce the amount of runways, and then the amount of airports altogether. Nothing else is going to make that system work. Well, very briefly, I've sketched out some of the possible technological and economic measures which could make this 90% cut happen. But you'll notice that what I haven't done is to sketch out the political measures which could make that cut feasible. And there is a reason for this. The reason is as follows. It is not up to me to demonstrate that that cut is politically feasible. It's up to you. Thank you.
That was George Monbiot launching his book Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning at the Sheldonian Theatre in Oxford on October the 19th, 2006. Many thanks to Peter Armstrong of OneClimate.net who recorded the talk, and to Climate Outreach and Information Network for putting on the event. Peter's website, by the way, is a great new addition to the world of online climate change resources. There's lots of useful video clips. You can watch a lecture given by Nicholas Stern on the economics of climate change, lots of audio recordings, and you can enter a virtual space where you can discuss solutions to climate change online. Make a note of the address, www.oneclimate.net. Also, make a note of the Climate Radio Archive address, where you can catch up on editions of the 2 Degrees Show that you missed earlier in the year. The address is coinnet. That's coinet.org.uk/climate radio. And while you've got your pen out, there's a summary of Monbiot's 10-point plan of action at www.monbiot.com. If you look in the climate change section for a piece entitled Here's the Plan. The 2 Degrees Show returns in January, and until then, happy Christmas and very best wishes for a low-carbon 2007.